if real estate is a dead letter for a while, if equities are hugely problematic, at least for a while, if the interest rate in my, you know, basic dollar holding, you know, goes away, what am I going to put my savings into? Well, you could buy antique Ferraris, you could buy casks of aging whiskey, or you could buy gold. And I think gold will be the winner in that trade. You know, the next big price move up is probably when the Fed pivots, and it seems likely that we go back into a 2009 to 2011 sort of trend.
This is Kaiser Johnson with Liberty in Finance, and this is the Miles Franklin Weekly Special for January 31st through February 7th, 2023, while supplies last. This week we feature 2023 Austrian Silver Philharmonics at just $3.29 over spot per ounce. Frequently regarded as one of the most beautiful sovereign coins, the Austrian Philharmonic portrays instruments from the Vienna Orchestra on one side and the grand pipe organ from the famed Augsburg Golden Hall on the other, all in 3/9 fine pure silver, with a face value of 1.5 euro. These 2023 Philharmonics come 20 to a tube, 500 to a box, are just $3.29 over spot, and are IRA eligible. And if you'd like to learn more about a precious metals IRA, call us, and we'll be happy to help you in that process. Our number for all orders is 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237. We're available after hours and on weekends, and we look forward to speaking with you.
Welcome back to Liberty and Finance. We're always glad to have this returning guest. Keith Wiener is the CEO of Monetary Metals, which takes a very impressive different stance on how to make a yield on your gold holdings by leasing them to others. And he also has extensive understanding of Austrian economics and sound money, and does a lot of research on what is going on in our financial world. He's here to talk with us today about the Gold Outlook 2023 report that just came out from Monetary Metals. Keith, thanks for coming back on Liberty and Finance.
Hey, Dunnigan, good to be here, and thanks for having me.
We want to tell everybody that we're recording this on Sunday, February 12th, but it's going to come out on Monday, so they can look forward to seeing it. And we're grateful for your presence here at the beginning of 2023 with this gold outlook for 2023 for Monetary Metals. It's an extensive research report. It takes many different perspectives. What are the main lenses that you looked at to give people a real understanding of what's going on both financially and monetarily around gold in 2023?
I think broadly, we kind of look at some of the common fallacies. We look at the current supply and demand conditions. And so we have a unique model that calculates or attempts to calculate what would happen if you backed out the effect of the speculators, because sometimes speculators can make big bets to, you know, the long to the upside, and sometimes they can make big bets short to the downside, and they use leverage to do so, so they can have a outsized but temporary impact on the price. What if you backed out the price effects of the speculators? Where would the metal be clearing? And thirdly, then we say, okay, that's the current conditions, but if you really want to get any insight as to where the price of gold or anything else for that matter is likely to be in a year or more, then you have to look at macroeconomics, because supply and demand conditions can change. And to that point, I think a lot of the dealers will tell you that as of November, you know, a lot of things were on back order. Retail demand was through the roof. That's not the case anymore. And it turned, you know, as these things often do, it turned on a dime.
Yeah, just to underscore what you were just referring to there, Andy Schechtman, the CEO of Miles Franklin Precious Metals, whom I interview every week on our channel for the weekly market update, was talking to us through September and October and November of the unprecedented high premiums that were prevailing all the way from the mints through the major distributors and so on in the retail market, as well as difficulty obtaining retail product, as well as increasingly, you know, record high retail demand for investable product, but not just at the retail level, also at the exchanges and off-taking from ETFs and sovereign central banks accumulating gold at record levels, as well as major buyers that are not typically in the normal retail market, like sovereign wealth funds and family offices and things like that. Can you tell us about that demand picture as you've seen it?
Well, I was going to say that's one of the fallacies that we identify. We call it the famous buyer fallacy. Oh, the gold ETF, GLD, is buying gold. Or this sovereign wealth fund is buying gold, or this central bank is buying gold. And the flip side is these 172,000 gold investors dump their gold. So who's right? Is it the 172,000 people who dumped it, or the one famous buyer who bought in large measure? And without knowing anything further, you really can't, there's no information value to be gleaned out of that whatsoever. Number one, probably all of the gold ever mined in 5,000 years of human history is still in human hands. And so these changes that we're talking about, if some central bank buys, as in the case of Ireland, a few tons, or even if China buys 1,000 tons, represents a really small corner of a really large cube of gold, number one. And so it's a small change at the margin. Number two, it just means that gold is sloshing around the pool from one side to the other. It tells you nothing about the overall level of the pool, the value of that pool priced in irredeemable currency units like dollars or anything else. The first thing you'd want to know is, did that famous buyer set a bid and then sellers dumped on that bid? Or were the sellers in a stronger position and they set an offer and the famous buyer lifted that offer in the process of buying? That's the first thing you'd want to know. But even then, okay, who's right? I mean, there's a presumption that, you know, the Irish Central Bank is smarter than 172,000 retail investors. Is that true? I don't know. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. And so I wouldn't try to read too much into these things. These are the, I call them factoids. It's not untrue that Ireland bought gold, but it's a factoid in that it isn't, it doesn't necessarily have the information value that people ascribe to it.
What other fallacies do you focus on in the beginning of your report?
Changes in so-called supply and demand. So changes in mine supply, electronics or jewelry demand at the margin. You know, again, gold has been held as a money balance for thousands of years. And, you know, these small changes at the margin don't really amount to anything. For that matter, changes in the Fed's balance sheet, changes in interest rates, real interest rates, nominal interest rates. If I may, I go off on my rant every time the topic of nominal or real interest rates comes up. And my rant is this: the actual rate at which actual lenders actually lend actual dollars to actual borrowers is dismissed with an airy wave of the hand as, well, that's nominal rate. But we separately calculate a consumer price index, which even the people who are proponents of this theory can't really agree as to what things should go into that consumer price index or what weights they should be given. But somehow we come up with a consumer price index, and then we calculate the rate of change of the consumer price index. We subtract that rate of change from the nominal interest rate to come up with a real interest rate at which no transactions are actually being done. So regardless of whether you look at nominal rates, real rates, Fed balance sheet, quantity of money, M0, M1, M2, whatever, you find that over long periods of time, there really is not a good correlation to the price of gold. There just isn't. You know, you can debate the theory as to why. You know, people that get PhDs in economics get all into, you know, it's kind of the debate of how many angels can dance on the head of a pin. But the fact is, they don't really correlate. And so people look at a lot of these factoids, and the mainstream press and, of course, the gold and alternative asset universe, you know, supply and demand. There's a lot of demand for these factoids, and there's a lot of sources of supply of these factoids. You know, people publishing all this stuff, and everybody gets wrapped around the axle about this and that. You know, at the end of the day, that's not, it's not helpful. And people who trade on this stuff sometimes make money, money being dollars in this context. Kind of ironic, they're using money, which is gold, to bet and make, you know, dollars. But sometimes they make dollars on their bets for the wrong reasons. You know, it's an idea that Keynes introduced. Keynes was largely almost perfectly wrong on everything, but he had one or two interesting insights. And one of them is the idea of what he called this beauty contest, which has come to be called the Keynesian beauty contest. Imagine if the newspaper published a picture of 100 beautiful women and said, I want you to write down the numbers of all these women in the standing order of who's the most beautiful. And whoever picks the most beautiful one, we'll get whatever in those days, $10,000 prize, which is a lot of money in those days. And what he talks about is that you're not trying to say who's actually objectively prettier. You're trying to outguess everyone else who's in the contest, and they're trying to outguess everyone else. So you're trying to figure out what the average person thinks that the average person will think is the prettiest. And so I think that mental framework explains a lot of the churn of markets. You know, the Fed says something and then suddenly the price of wheat shoots up, 30% that day. Usually it's back down within a week, but people who successfully picked up on that hint and understood what the mainstream, trading theory is, can make a lot of money on that bet. And then as long as they're smart enough to get out, as long as they don't think it's durable, they realize it's just going to be a blip. Get in, get out. Take, of that 30% move, take 20 of those percents and be happy and move on and don't be greedy. And there's an awful lot of that goes on in the market, including the gold market.
Well, I know a lot of our viewers are in what they are doing is trying to focus on what's going to be durable, what's going to be lasting, what's going to help ensure their family's financial future, and so that they can not only survive but thrive in the times that are coming. Any more myths or debunking that we should do before we move on to what you think are the salient points that people should be thinking about?
Yeah, I mean, there's just so much mythology out there. We're actually going to be putting out a separate white paper, and we call it How Not to Think About Gold, that looks at all of these myths. And obviously the elephant in the room when we're talking about myths of gold is that gold is somehow vastly manipulated. Its price is kept thousands of dollars, if not tens of thousands of dollars, below where it ought to be, quote unquote, by some nefarious cabal, which is that at sometimes that Mr. nefarious cabal is accused of profiteering off the losses of the traders, and at other times accused of being a not-for-profit who's not interested in making money, but that's serving, the nefarious deep state who wants to keep gold down or whatever. And so for decades, gold ought to be, $100,000 an ounce, but it's a mere 1800 something because of this dark cabal. And every price move is taken as if that were evidence, as if that were proof. And one picture was proof of, a theory, of what causes it, which of course is absurd. You see a price chart that shows the price moves down. That's not a proof of any particular explanation. At most, it is raises a question of what caused this. And the cause is not visible in the price data itself. So I think we probably have the distinction of being the ones who've written the most to debunk the idea of a price manipulation. I wrote a piece called Thoughtful Disagreement with Ted Butler. So Ted Butler, probably the most famous, at least a few years ago, of the silver manipulation conspiracy guys, basically said, hey, look, I'm retired now. I'm like emeritus, and I've done my work. I've introduced the world to this problem. And contributed this body of ideas to knowledge and science. And in that spirit, I encourage thoughtful disagreement, if anybody has any. So I said, okay, I'll take up the gauge. And in that spirit, here's thoughtful disagreement. Let me first start out with a steel man of your position. Let me try to state your position in terms that even you would agree with, and then proceed to to address it. And in that article, we published unique data that we've compiled going back to 1996. And essentially the article was a scientific hypothesis that, okay, if you have two theories, what you do is you look for the corner case where those theories predict opposite outcomes. And what is the place where the manipulation conspiracy theory and the arbitrage theory, if we call it that, predict opposite directions for how futures contract would move. And then here's the data that shows, 20 odd years of those moves, and therefore we can show conclusively that the manipulation conspiracy theory just isn't right. So I would say anybody trying to trade based on this conspiracy theory just is at risk of either they could be right for the wrong reasons. You can buy gold and the price goes up and you sell it and you made a profit, and the reasons for why that happened aren't necessarily the ones you thought. So, okay, bully for you if you do that. But, you know, if you buy for all the wrong reasons, there's a significant risk that you may be wrong and the price moves against you. And then you say, curses, it was that damn dark cabal foiled me again. It's not so.
You mentioned in your report the elephant in the room, as you call it, about the four decades long era of falling interest rates. Is that, in fact, one of the what you think is one of the drivers of actual causes of movement in the markets over the past four decades that most people maybe aren't looking at?
Yeah, kind of indirectly. So I think the price of gold is going to move up when the interest rate is below time preference. So every person has their own idea of time preference. And if the interest rate is below that, then the dollar and a dollar deposit are not really serving that person's needs. So the person looks for alternatives, and gold is the one of the top logical alternatives. Of course, people love to go into the stock market. And so to go into the stock market, they're not necessarily going into gold. But generally, over time, gold will get that capital inflow because of all the logical reasons of why it's been money for thousands of years.
You get into a section after that where you talk about what we know and what we don't know. I found that particularly pointed. Do you want to walk us through that? I think that our viewers would appreciate sort of the definitiveness of that. Talking about ever-increasing mandatory useless ingredients make it harder and harder to get return on capital, falling interest rates incentivize borrowing, and then also whether the Fed is just after a lot of years of this easy easing, you have a lot of companies out there who were dependent on that, and when that environment is no longer prevalent, they can't make a profit anymore, so you end up with these zombie companies, which put banks at risk.
That's right. So I think that might have been my discussion of have we turned a corner? Are we now in a period of there's going to be a new rising interest rate trend or not? And how to understand what has driven prices up so sharply in the last couple of years? And I think a lot of people are under the assumption that only a change in the quantity of money drives a change in the general price level. And so I've spent a lot of articles over the last, 3 years documenting non-monetary causes for prices to rise. And the first one being mandatory useless ingredients, a term that I thought of when I thought about how gasoline, and if you go to the pump and you put gas in your car and you read the sticker on the pump, you realize it's not pure gasoline, that they're forced to put either ethanol or some chemical like MBTE, methyl butyltetraethylene, I think it stands for, I'm not sure, which adds a lot of cost to that gallon of gas. I think it's about 25 or 30 cents. The consumer doesn't value it at all. In fact, it reduces your gas mileage, increases the price, and I don't think a lot of consumers are even really aware of it. And so that's the quintessential useless ingredient. Everything that we can buy, whether it's a good or a service, has lots and lots and lots of useless ingredients mandated by the regulators. In most cases, they're much less visible even than MBTE. At least there's a pump that you can read, once or twice a week that has that sticker on it. In most other cases, you would never know all the useless ingredients just in your car. 17 airbags and all these extra strength crumple zones and this and that and the other thing. And how much of that would be there, in a free market, i.e. by the demand of consumers, and how much of that is the diktat of regulators. But it's driving the prices up of everything, relentlessly. And so that's number one. Now, post-COVID, the obvious thing is that first there was a lockdown, which was enormous destruction of supply. All of a sudden, companies that produce things weren't able to either produce them because the workers were all sent home, or the companies themselves were shut down because they weren't deemed to be essential, or they could produce their stuff and it stacked up in warehouses, but you couldn't ship it anywhere because they totally screwed the logistics and shipping industries. Then there was an unlock, and that created this incredible whiplash. The whole supply chain was designed to operate just in time. Then you shut it down for 18 months, and then you think that you're just pressing the resume button like on a VCR, and it doesn't work that way. And so you create all the shocks there. Then finally is trade war, and not just tariffs, but there's a huge reshoring movement where companies that had moved to manufacture in places like China for cost reasons are suddenly now being either directly ordered by the government, or they see the writing on the wall and they figure we better do it now while we have some maneuverability and some grace period. Otherwise, they're going to come and force us to do it anyway. And so now you're going to try to manufacture all this electronic stuff in the U.S. and all kinds of other things for which there was not millions and millions of workers looking for these jobs anyways, number one. Number two, you know, you have other higher cost reasons, cost factors, including regulations once again. And then, of course, you have tariffs. And it's not just, you know, Chinese imported aluminum. It's Canadian lumber. It's Scotch whiskey. It's all sorts of things are subject to rising tariffs, and not just in the U.S., but this is a global, you know, trend. And then finally, you have what I call green energy restrictions. Place after place after place is imposing ridiculous regulations that are either completely impossible to comply with or just drive the cost up. California increasingly mandated cars have to be electric. California hasn't added anything to their electric grid, I think, since the late 1970s. And now you're going to put this enormous new load on the electric grid. So they're having rolling brownouts, and they're going to be rationing electricity, all of which just adds generally to prices. Not even getting into the stimmy checks, the moratorium on evictions and foreclosures. They'll let people live rent-free for years, and then they can spend all the money they would have been spending on rent on consumer goods. So all of which, you know, tends to drive prices up. The Fed then thinks, oh, inflation is rising, let's hike interest rates, and we're going to cure that. But what hiking interest rates is going to do is it's not going to reduce the spending allotment of people that are living rent-free because of an eviction moratorium. No, it's going to make it more expensive for companies to finance production, and it's going to put the marginal producer out of business. And so it's going to, you know, they think they're trying to kill demand, but of course they're killing supply because supply is demand. So they're killing supply in the theory that that's going to reduce prices. And that's the moment in time that we're in right now.
It's so bewildering to many what direction we're heading here, because we're seeing some of the markets, the bond market for one, the stock market to some extent, having had one of their worst years in a long time. And people are thinking, gee, maybe this is the beginning of a big recession. This is the beginning of a big deflationary period, that sort of thing. Other hand, we see continued increase in prices and the inflation for consumer goods. Do you have a model that you believe is more trustworthy, that you rely on what direction things are heading, either from an inflationary or deflationary position? Or do you think both those things will be happening at the same time, just in different segments of different asset classes?
So I think that the non-monetary forces for rising prices are still in place. On the other hand, I think that's probably a waning trend. In other words, we passed a lot of green energy restrictions. I think there's some political backlash, certainly in Europe, who took it to greater extremes than anything we've seen in America yet. I think that that trend is in place, I think that's kind of a diminishing trend. And then the question is, on the monetary front, are we going to continue to have rising interest rates? Obviously, the Fed wants interest rates to rise. The Fed has direct control over the overnight rate, and the farther out you go on the duration, curve, the farther out the maturities, the less control the Fed has. So what they've done is they've spiked overnight and, let's say, 1 month rates to, you know, crazy highs. And then you look at the 10-year treasury, the rate has gone up, but not nearly as much as the Fed funds rate. And so you actually have an inversion, not of just the 10-year to 2-year, which a lot of people look as an indicator of recession, not just the 10-year and 3 months, but the 10-year and Fed funds rate are inverted. So the analogy is they're pushing on a string. They want rates to rise, but they only have direct control on the very short end of the curve. The question I think people should be asking, if there is a durable rising rates trend, then that necessarily means that as price goes up, buyers, or in this case borrowers, are are seeking to buy or borrow more, the higher rates go, the more they want to borrow. Now, that was true from 1947 to 1981. The more rates would go up, they were drivers of why companies wanted to borrow more and more and more at higher and higher and higher rates. Does anybody think that that is really true today? I don't think they do. I just don't think people are framing the question in those terms. I think people are saying, well, inflation is up and interest rates have to go up because investors demand, you know, compensation for their, you know, the losses due to inflation. But of course, it doesn't work that way. So I say to people, okay, go out and buy a brand new BMW, and now your personal expenses have gone up, you know, let's say $800 a month. Now go to your boss and say, my expenses are up, and therefore I get a raise, right? I don't think it works that way. I think your boss is likely to say, well, I'm willing to forget we had this little conversation if you leave my office now. And, you know, it's the same thing. Okay, so consumer prices are going up, but it's nothing to do with the interest rate market, not directly and not in the way people assume. In order for rates to be going up, borrowers have to be bidding them up. Where do we see that? Where do we see an increased desire to buy more houses at higher prices and borrow more at higher rates, or by corporations, which already were 20% zombies at 0% interest rates, and now that interest rates have been jacked up so much, they want to borrow more? They don't have the capacity. And even if they had the business opportunity, which they don't have the collateral. Collateral values drop as interest rates rise. So if they're already 100% saturated, you know, at 0% interest rates, now where's their collateral value? They're over-leveraged, they're looking to deleverage, they're looking to get out of some of their debt if they can. But when the whole world is trying to do that at the same time, then that's what you call a deflationary, period.
In your report, the second half, you switch over to the actual 2023 outlook for gold and silver. Why don't we, if with your permission, move to that now and tell us what you see ahead and what factors you think will really be driving and affecting the movement of the metals markets for the remainder of this year.
Well, I think the getting back to the Keynesian beauty contest, I think it's a question of when, not if, the Fed realizes that it has to, if it wants to keep the game going anyway. That's my assumption. The Fed doesn't want to destroy the system over which it presides, because usually when the system is destroyed, the people that used to have power in the old system are not the ones who have take power in the new system. Usually there's a heads that roll when the mob gets angry enough with the torches and the pitchforks. So assuming that they want to keep the game going, they're going to have to reverse and start cutting interest rates. And the only question is when the carnage grows great enough for them to recognize that they're at that point. When that happens, I think that's the Keynesian beauty contest, that will be a huge signal for people to buy gold. Ah, the Fed is going to go back to its old inflationary ways. We knew this so-called, moment of rectitude or whatever the Fed would want to try to position it. We're going to lick inflation. We knew that was only a head fake, or, you know, whatever term people want to use for it. They're now back to their old inflationary ways, buy gold. But underlying that is, right now, the interest rate on the dollar is actually pretty attractive. All you have to do is buy short-term bills, and you can get near 5%. That's a pretty good deal, and I bet that's way over most people's time preference at the moment. And so, there's not necessarily... purely from a comparing the deal you get in gold versus comparing the deal you get in dollars, leaving aside that the dollar is unsound and there's all these other problems, the credit risk problems of the dollar and the inflation risk problem of the dollar, the interest rate equation right now is tilted pretty strongly in favor of the dollar. It's a pretty damn good deal. Now, if you buy 10-year treasuries, not only are you getting, it's more like 3.7%, but you also have the possibility of outsized capital gains when this reverses. And if you buy shortly before that, you could see a big gain. You know, buy the bond, hold it for a few months and sell it and see a giant gain. So I think there's a lot of people that wouldn't necessarily be buying gold because they're going to be looking at either just parking their money in bills or parking their money in longer term bonds and then waiting for the big gain. But when the Fed reverses and that happens, both of those factors go away and the unsoundness of the dollar then reverts as the main consideration. And I think aside from the Keynesian beauty contest, oh, the Fed's going to be inflating again, increasing quantity of money, increasing prices, increasing gold, which isn't really right, either theoretically and empirically, the data doesn't bear that out. However, the reasons for holding the dollar kind of strip away, and then you're back to, why am I holding this dollar again? If I want to hold savings, you know, what do I hold my savings in is the perennial question. If real estate is a dead letter for a while, if equities are hugely problematic, for at least for a while, if the interest rate in my, you know, basic dollar holding, you know, goes away, what am I going to put my savings into? Well, you could buy antique Ferraris, you could buy casks of aging whiskey, or you could buy gold. And I think gold will be the winner in that trade. And so, you know, the next big price move up is probably when the Fed pivots, and it seems likely that we go back into a 2009 to 2011, you know, sort of trend, you know, when that, you know, with perhaps with some lag, but when the Fed does that, that seems the likely response.
You've been referring to gold. Do you see silver responding in synchronization with gold, or lagging behind it, or driven by completely different fundamentals in addition to the ones that you mentioned?
So I think there's some key differences with between silver and gold, which I'll get into in a moment. But it bears emphasis that when you plot silver's correlation against various other commodities, it trades most correlated to gold than versus copper or crude oil or other things. That said, there's a key difference, and that is silver was always the commodity that wage earners, ordinary workers, turned to put their savings into. If you want to take 10% of your weekly wage and buy a monetary metal, gold doesn't really work very well. First of all, you have some really minuscule piece of gold, which is, you know, easy to lose and expensive to manufacture, and also not very exciting to hold a little fleck of gold. So if you put $50 into silver, on the other hand, you got a decent stack of coins. You know, let's say 2 1-ounce coins, or if you had smaller coins, you get a stack of them. And so it's the wage earner that turns to silver, whereas gold trades more against other capital assets by the capital asset owning class. That said, the capital owning class can buy silver as well if they think it's a deal. And so I think that keeps a lid on the gold silver ratio. So going forward, I think silver is more sensitive to the plight of the wage earner. And so it depends on how this, you know, Fed continuing to hike rates and then pivot when the carnage is great enough, how does that affect workers? And if workers are getting laid off in large numbers, then that doesn't necessarily bode well for silver. On the other hand, if the Fed says we're cutting rates, then you can see the capital classes, you know, buy a lot of silver because they just smell a deal. If you can buy silver at a 85-1, much less 100-1 ratio against gold, why not buy some silver? We certainly have clients ask that question all the time. Isn't silver the better deal at these ratios? Yeah, it probably is. If there's any kind of reversion to the mean that's ever going to happen again, then you know, I wouldn't necessarily be a buyer of silver at ratio 30, as we got in April of 2011. But you know, the ratio of 85 or 100, it almost seems like you couldn't do wrong. So I think, you know, that's the sort of immediate driver. The longer term driver is the soundness of the dollar continues to rot and decay, and more and more people at the margin. And every time there's one of these little incidents, you know, our monetary masters, I call them the dirigistes, who think that they can manipulate us into having a better economy for ourselves by manipulating the quantity, the value, or the price of money, i.e. interest rate, they don't understand the system that they prevail over. They're at best a race car driver with no idea how a race car is engineered. They just know how to turn the steering wheel and when to hit the brake pedal a little bit. And every once in a while, there's some giant wreck that occurs, which is beyond their understanding. None of them predicted 2008. None of them predicted, other things that have happened. And but every time one of these little wreckages occurs, there's X number of people. It looks like you froze. Oh, there you're back. There's X number of people who suddenly turn to gold for the first time in their lives and think, I've never bought this asset before, but now I'm going to buy some. And I think this next pivot, there'll be a whole nother group of people who buy gold for the first time in their lives, just as they look at the, the problems in the monetary system and the problems with the central planners of the monetary system.
So could you give us a summary of what you see as the major trend for both gold and for silver in 2023 and what you think people should be aware of as they anticipate whether or not they're going to take a first step or a next step in acquiring of those assets?
If it's a first step, I'd say, look, don't even worry about the trend. Just if you don't have any gold, you should buy some and have it. And it's not even really a matter of price, because that's your safety margin. That's a little bit that's just not subject to all these gyrations. And it's not, gold is not anyone else's liability. There's no counterparty. If you own a lump of gold, as Warren Buffett derides it, I'll turn it the other way and say this is a virtue, not a demerit, then there's nobody else that you have to depend on to make good on it. It is what it is. If you have some and you're thinking of buying more, or if you want to trade it, I think that the overall context is that post 2020, we're in a generally bull market for the metals. Obviously, there can be big swings and dips and corrections along the way, but I think something changed. I think there was a sea change in 2020 that ended the bear market of arguably 2012 through 2018, 2019. And I think that continues because the monetary rot has accelerated. And there's a variety of reasons for that. The short answer is the system doesn't really want to stay in motion. It tends to want to seize up. And every time that the friction starts to drag it to a halt, they have to put another little zhuzh, another little shot of first adrenaline, then cocaine, then crack, then methamphetamine. I don't know what escalating order of analogies to use for drugs, but they have to keep increasing the dosage and increase the type of the drug in order to try to get back to even. And they can't really get back to even. It just continues to worsen and worsen. And that trend has now become more obvious post even 2020. And so I think that just continues to drive behavior as more and more people decide to have more and more gold, more and more dollars worth of gold. Of course, the quantity of gold doesn't really change all that much. The miners produce a little bit more at the margin. So it's not like on net people can have more gold, but they can have more dollars worth of it. As they think about balancing and rebalancing their portfolios, the average person can say, well, I don't necessarily just want $10,000 worth of gold. I'd rather have $50,000 worth. And so that's the process of repricing gold, or as I would argue, the inverse is repricing the dollar. If their desire to hold the dollar goes down, when you don't want to hold dollars, what do you hold? It's gold. And I think that trend has reasserted itself with a vengeance post 2020. And now we'll see, it's very hard to predict these kind of nonlinear events. How violent is it going to be when the Fed announces, hey, all that stuff about hiking rates and curing inflation? Yeah, well, we lied. We're reversing right back to where we'd been. How violent is going to be the reaction to that? Nobody can really say. If somebody says, well, yeah, gold's going to go to 10,000, it's like, well, I wouldn't bet against that, but I wouldn't bet on that either, if you know what I mean. And so we'll have to see when that is. My gut tells me that's likely to be sometime later this year, But to really try to predict something like that is very difficult because it's political. It's not really an economic question. It's a political question. Which party is going to be bossing the Fed around? How much independence does the Fed really have? What are the power games that are going on behind closed doors? How much of the Fed's move is to try to stick it to the ECB or the Bank of England or the Bank of Japan? How much does one party, you know, think that they're actually primarily harming the other party? Remember the whole thing about the deductibility of state and local taxes? And the Republicans somehow got on board with the idea that state and local taxes shouldn't be deductible because they thought they were punishing blue states. Yeah, the politics can be very perverse. And it's nothing to do with fairness. It's nothing to do with economics and everything to do with how one, you know, political faction thinks they're getting something for themselves or just sticking it to somebody they don't like and hurting their enemies. And so predicting that's very, very hard. However, the economic pain of the higher rates is high and rising. That is what we do know.
It's going to be an eventful year by many measures. We certainly have seen a lot of strains increasing in terms of the fragility. As you mentioned, it keeps taking larger and larger doses of injections of liquidity, et cetera, stimulus from the Fed or other agencies to try to keep things rolling. You've talked about the risk to banks if zombie companies go under and then those bad debts are visible, that sort of thing. What's your number one concern for the remainder of this year? Perhaps it's all of these, I guess you called them potential wrecks or major dislocations that could happen that it's difficult to pin down the time frame on, but maybe it's something else.
Yeah, no, I think you touched on it in your question, which is defaults are coming. Defaults are my number one concern. Most people ask about recession, but recession is kind of downstream of credit. You know, to say politics is downstream of culture. You want to understand where politics are going, ask where culture is going or has already gone, and then you'll see it in politics in 10 or 20 years. Where's credit going? And right now what we're seeing is startups finding it almost impossible to raise money. Therefore, they're being told to lay off, do whatever they have to do to get cash flow positive, which for most of them is probably not even possible. So first layoffs and then wholesale closures. All the major companies are doing layoffs. And I say that somewhat sticking my neck out. Not every major company has announced a layoff yet. However, I'm confident they all will because it's a contractionary environment. The rising price of credit has made it untenable for them to be in their marginal businesses. Macy's said they're closing X number of stores. Every marginal store of every retailer, restaurant, whatever, is going to get closed. And then how much of that is going to be defaults? How much of that is somebody going to be able to sell off an asset to another buyer? At what price to deleverage the balance sheet and avoid default? You know, remains to be seen. All those laid off workers, they have home payments and car and truck payments and credit card payments and all of that. And, you know, that begins to stack up. And, you know, when exactly is the timing of when that blows up? To answer that question, you'd have to know where is the wall of maturities. You know, companies have all this debt that's always, you know, rolling, but any given company might not have a bond that matures until 2024 or 2025. So they won't default until the interest rate resets for them, but that's at the next rollover, which isn't necessarily right now. So you'd have to see a plot of that to kind of get a sense of when that's, you know, when that's happening. I can tell you, so right now I'm here in Las Vegas. That's a hotel room that you see behind me. I normally live in Phoenix, and I decided to get out of town because of the Super Bowl and the Waste Management Open. You know, the town is overflowing with tourists. It's like, okay, this might be a good time to escape. You might think, okay, well, Vegas would be just as crazy. It's pretty darn dead here. Like, these hotels are, I don't know what percentage of empty they are, but pretty empty. We were walking around, you know, last night at 10 o'clock, there just wasn't, the crowd looked really sparse. So, you know, some people are obviously already feeling it. And then that will continue to get worse and worse. So not only do you have rising interest rates, rising cost of debt service, the debt doesn't go away, but the cost to service it goes up at the same time that revenues fall. Everybody who's lost their job is obviously not spending the way they used to, but everybody who's worried that they're going to lose their job is also not spending the way they used to. And maybe Vegas is the marginal recipient of that spending. I don't know. If so, then that becomes a canary in the coal mine. But I think all these different trends, whether it's actual default, whether it's fear of default, whether it's cram downs, the lenders may not be eager to actually take a default, so they agree to take a haircut, or they take what's called PIC, payment in kind. It's okay, you have this thing that's due next year, but we'll allow you to repay it with another note that's due in 5 years. So the extending the maturity is a form of default. Workers that are laid off, not spending anymore, all of these things speak to not only reduced economic activity, but greater strain on the debtors, as we keep ratcheting up the stress on, can they service their debts? And, until the problems explode so much that even the Fed and their ivory tower, it seems like the people are on fire down there. They'll look out the window and the flames are high enough to reach their window ledge. Oh, okay, we should do something. This looks terrible. And then they reverse and into the next cycle.
Sounds like you are also anticipating some major events ahead when these strains build up to the point that the system can't sustain it, or politically or financially. People who want to follow your writing on this, and you write pretty often, we were referring to your 2023 Gold Outlook. There's a link in the description of this video if people want to obtain that from Monetary Metals. If people want to follow your writing more often, how should they do that?
So my Twitter is @RealKeithWiener. And most of my economics stuff is posted at monetary-metals.com. And then I have a personal economic site called keithwienereconomics.com.
We've been speaking with Keith Wiener, the CEO of Monetary Metals. And Keith, as always, thanks for joining us. The topics that you're able to speak on range so widely that it's hard for us sometimes to know where to tap into that that mine of information so that we can glean some insights that we need. But you've given us a lot to think about, and I know that your report, which is not that long, about 22 pages, it reads quite smoothly. So people, take advantage of that. Go look in the description of this video, and you can obtain the report through the link that's in the description of this video. Keith, as always, thanks for joining us on Liberty and Finance.
Thanks for having me.
Miles Franklin Precious Metals is one of America's oldest and most trusted bullion dealers. Miles Franklin is A-plus rated and accredited by the Better Business Bureau, licensed and bonded, and has zero complaints ever registered. Here at Liberty and Finance, we are licensed brokers with Miles Franklin. To order, simply call us, discuss your needs, and we can let you know our live inventory, prices, and availability, and lock in your order over the phone. Once your order is locked, the price is held for you regardless of market fluctuations, and the metals are reserved for you awaiting your settled payment. Within one business day of ordering, you will receive an email invoice detailing the order and payment instructions. Miles Franklin accepts payments by bank wire, ACH or electronic check, money order, check mailed priority mail, and cryptocurrency. The fastest forms of payment are bank wire and cryptocurrency. Upon settled payment, metals will ship out within 3 to 5 business days. You will receive tracking information via email. Domestic shipping charges are $15 for any order under 500 ounces of silver or 10 ounces of gold. For orders larger than that, domestic shipping is free. The package will be boxed, fully insured, and labeled discreetly, with no indication of the contents inside. For your privacy, the name Miles Franklin will not even be on the package. To talk to myself, Kaiser, my brother Elijah, or my father Dunnigan, call 1-888-81-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-815-4237.